Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast episode 201. It's we considered briefly renumbering with a brand new number one.
Right, and but then we would just have to go back to legacy numbering eventually.
Yeah, you'll be listed episodes.
I think that would be timely, though.
You listed episodes 1 through 13, and then episode 214 would just pop up the next week.
Well, we would get a listenership boost if we had a new number one.
Yeah, that's true.
And it would go up in value.
That's true.
Right.
Point. We could do a Chromium version.
Yes.
I don't know how that works with a podcast.
What are we talking about?
I want to get graded. Can we get graded?
Yes. We're going to be slabbed by CGC, which sounds like a violent act.
You know, it's weird. 201 as a totemic number reminds me of a comic I had as a kid. I think was Amazing Spider-Man 201, and I believe it was one of those notable Punisher issues before he was everywhere.
Yeah.
But only by a few years.
201 reminds me of X-Men 201, which is where Cyclops and Storm battled in the Danger Room for leadership of the X-Men.
Hugely notable issue. Nick, you got a 201?
I don't, actually.
I feel like I have
GTFO.
I thought you were going to say, Dave, we have to fight now. But, you know.
Welcome to the Roguecast, Nick. Hope you survived the experience.
I think I can take you both.
He's right.
All right. Store news. Quick mention again that D&D Adventurers League is going strong. We have it on Tuesday night. We have one table. Thursday night, we have four tables. Call in the morning to reserve your spots because it does go quick. Today, it's... We managed to hold out until, I think, about 1 o'clock before we lost our final spot.
Yep.
Thursday, we actually were able to have a little room this week because of spring break, probably. Come out, play D&D. It's all the kids are doing it.
Yeah, there's a reason it's so popular. And so if you've got, whether you know you haven't played in a while and you want to get back into it, if you've never played, it's obviously a good time. Or if you've got friends who are like, man, I want to see what this D&D is all about, tell them to come down our way.
That's true. Also, coming up in April, Sunday, April 22nd, we'll have our Magic the Gathering Dominaria pre-release.
Right.
So just put that on people's radar. And on to our other news.
Yep.
So there's a couple big movie stories. The big one was Ana de Vernay, coming off of Wrinkle in Time, is going to direct New Gods.
Right.
Now, we should say first, these early director announcements rarely pan out.
Right.
Like, she may be gone in 6 months.
And everything about sort of, I would say, in some ways, the DC movie-verse is kind of feels like it's up in the air right now.
Yeah, it's always in flux.
Because, what, Justice League, we determined when we were talking about this earlier, like, it generally underperformed.
It did not well.
Okay. I wasn't sure if we made it all up in, like, overseas markets. Like,
In Singapore, it
was, like, you know, a blockbuster.
It was profitable in the same way Batman vs. Superman was profitable, but it wasn't the blockbuster they wanted it to be.
Yeah, right. But it did introduce all the New Gods stuff in its way.
Right,
so
they name dropped what? Steppenwolf, Apocalypse, Mother Boxes.
Yeah. They've definitely paved the way for a New Gods.
So here's the thing. I believe none of us have seen A Wrinkle in Time.
None of us have seen Wrinkle in Time,
but everybody's seen the
are mediocre.
Kind of mediocre, yeah. From the trailer alone, I could see it was very visually stylish, though. It reminded me a little bit of like the same way. In some ways, the way I'll hear criticisms of Julie Taymor movies, but they also are always visually very very bold and dramatic.
Well, and whatever the results on Wrinkle in Time, Selma was, by all accounts, a fantastic movie.
Yeah. Right.
So DuVernay seems like someone who I would trust. The weirdest thing is, like, the notion of the New Gods, everybody started immediately throwing out casting. And I think maybe partly because this is the first black woman to direct a major superhero blockbuster. There was a lot of race-blind casting going on, which I found very interesting. Because people were talking about who would be... everyone, of course, was making the joke about Oprah because Oprah's in Wrinkle in Time. And someone said, Oprah could be Granny Goodness or something like that. And I'm like, no, man, Oprah could be Highfather. And you can't tell me Oprah wouldn't be a great Highfather.
That's kind of true. There's few people who have that kind of immediate presence to be a person who you would say would be, oh, this is sort of an all-knowing God figure.
Yeah,
she could be one of those people.
Yeah. It would be both gender-flipped and race-flipped, and people would freak their shit.
I have a casting suggestion that is not colorblind casting, but who is the guy, this actor, I think I just saw some tribute to him like on Facebook or something, maybe it was his birthday or something, but when in the flashbacks in Lord of the Rings, when you saw Gollum when he was like... human or like when he was a hobbit.
Yeah.
He wasn't played by what's his name?
Andy Serkis?
Andy Serkis, was he?
I think he was, but I don't know.
Yeah, I thought he was.
Okay, because I thought there was maybe another guy, but anyway, whoever played him then, maybe Andy Serkis for Desaad.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I feel like he's got that kind of a bit of what I'm going to say is an oily look about
it. Well, and having seen Andy Serkis play Claw, I can see him playing Desaad with that sort of wicked glee.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I also am going to throw out, I've seen this posted numerous times, Gwendolyn Christie for Barda.
Who's that?
That is from
Phasma.
Game of Thrones. What's her name in Game of Thrones?
Brienne.
Brienne.
Oh, man.
She'd be amazing. Plus, she got hosed out of Phasma. Phasma's a terrible character.
Yes, I'm afraid
it's true. She needs a good role.
I mean, and then she's the Boba Fett of the...
Yeah, but not even as cool as Boba Fett.
I mean, Boba Fett got punked out, too,
that's
honestly.
True. But there was also talk of who you could cast as Mr. Miracle, and there were some good suggestions. I'm trying to remember who they were. I think it would have been tied to... No, maybe it was Oscar Isaac. I think maybe it was like the two of them were at like the awards together because you know they're both in Star Wars and they're like these two as Barda and Scott and I'm like I can see that.
Colorblind casting, by the way, I feel like somebody young like Donald Glover or something could also be Mr. Miracle.
Oh, Donald Glover as Shiloh Norman would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I was just thinking
he would just be Scott Free, but just a colorblind flip.
Yeah.
But as Shiloh, that would be awesome too.
Yeah.
Have a little bit of chemistry. Do Jamie. I forget his
name. Oh, that's who it was, actually. That's,
Jamie
that's
Lannister.
It, that's
it. As who? As
Nicholas, Nikolai Coster-Waldau.
Yeah, as Scott Free.
Yeah.
Too old.
Yeah, he is. That's true.
But...
He's not that old.
He's in his 40s.
Who would you guess for Orion?
I mean, Mr. Miracle's got to be in his 20s.
Yeah. Although, I'm not sure he can pull it off. But Nikolai Coster-Waldau.
You
got to
cast
whatever,
with long-term in mind.
He could actually be Orion. Because Ryan could look a little bit older. I don't think he's not who I'd cast.
Oh, the Jamie?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, you know, when Orion has his calm face on, he's like, I would get sort of like ruggedly handsome.
Yeah.
And I feel like he would have the presence to do it.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I have, of course, checked out of DC.
Yeah.
They need to make several more good movies before I'm excited about this, but
right.
I'm intrigued by the notion of the new gods.
One of the things I kind of like, just based on the visuals I saw, the wild visuals I saw in the trailers for A Wrinkle in Time, is I have this feeling that she would actually try and kind of represent what we've seen in the comics.
Yeah.
Now, I think it might be even, like, weirder in some ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, you know how New Genesis always has, like, floating cities, mm-hmm. and, you know, it looks kind of like this Eden, but with cool floating shit.
I think Thor Ragnarok set the pattern that you can do Kirby style look.
Exactly.
So I want it to look like that, bright and colorful and weird.
But I also want like an apocalypse with the you know, fire pits that are the size of states.
Yeah.
You know, on the surface of that, and
I'm just gonna be sad if they don't get Michael Ironside for Darkseid.
He was good voice. He would not be the right guy to play Darkseid.
But don't you do just a voice? You do CGI?
Just all CGI? No,
Make him as lame as Steppenwolf?
Exactly. No, you want an actor with presence.
Actually, you know what would be interesting is to take... Go ahead and... you know, some of the most convincing special effects were some of the, like, in Lord of the Rings, when they hobbited down the people.
Yeah.
I assume you could take a regular guy, build him up with a big costume and stuff like that, and also just make him look like he's 8 feet tall.
Yeah.
But I think, you could go with an actor under makeup.
Just make Michael Ironside as...
I don't think Ironside's too old, and he's become like a B-lister.
I know.
He's playing the Flash as the Captain Cold's dad on the Flash.
I know.
That guy is not going to be Darkseid.
His voice is so iconic.
His voice is great. But yeah, he's not the guy. I don't know who I'd cast. Maybe you just cast Josh Brolin as Darkseid as well.
Perpetually,
because they are the same character.
I mean, for the most part.
All right. Speaking of, we got our possibly final, but definitely a big Avengers Infinity War trailer.
It's the final one. They'll do some TV snippets, but
I should not be watching these trailers because I know I'm going to go see the movie, but I couldn't resist, and it's a good trailer.
I mean, I think
they're not showing too much, or they're showing it so fast that I. Because I'm not sticking around to pore over every scene, I think, like you, I watched it twice.
Yeah.
I've watched it more than that.
But I don't want to lock on to scenes and recognize necessarily what's going on.
Right.
I was content to be kind of dazzled and be like, oh, just catch just little snippets of kind of what the story was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the Russo brothers, or whoever built this trailer, did a good job of giving you just little scenes.
Yeah.
But not giving you sort of a grand design. You'd know, you know exactly what's going to happen. I mean, don't.
Some of the biggest things. I think we saw that, like, the Cap meeting Black Panther, sort of, like looks like maybe a rival in Wakanda type stuff.
Well, not meeting, because he's in Wakanda. He's not at the end of Civil War.
Yeah, that's where Cap
He also met him during Civil War when he punched his face.
I've only seen it once. When I say meeting, I meant, like, meeting in terms of, like, for the present mission.
Yeah, yeah.
It looked like they were...
There was some kind of gathering, but he's in Wakanda.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that operating out of Wakanda. It was a little weird to me, because it's like he and Black Widow, and I'm like, you guys have been here. Why is this like a thing? But yeah.
But that may be like a formal meeting. Yeah. Sort of like we need to have a war council to talk about the Thanos coming.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, when I come into work, I don't feel like it's us meeting. You know, we've seen each other. We've known each other before. Like,
Did you feel like they were meeting for the first time?
No.
Oh, okay. Wakanda's ceremonial. They might literally have, like, here, let's go into this chamber to have our war council.
Yeah. I don't know, it's just weird to me, because the end of Civil War, Cap is in the lab with Black Panther talking to him. They're clearly friends now.
Yeah.
So, like, this notion of, like, a meeting between the two of them, I was a little weirded out by it. Maybe Cap leaves and goes...
Isn't this, like, at the end of Civil War, is he Beardo Cap?
No, so some time has passed.
Some time has passed, and maybe he even, like, went off on his own. He's like, maybe I've got to, like, go get right in my head.
Well, you have to realize at the end of Civil War, he breaks out all the Avengers.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, having them running around together as a team...
Is that post-Wakanda?
Yes.
I thought the order it went in was he breaks everybody out of jail, and then there's the Wakanda scene. I'm pretty sure that's the order.
My
thought was that took place, that he broke the Avengers out, they're all in Wakanda.
I think so. I think that is the case.
But I don't know. At any rate, yeah, I think that makes sense that he and Widow or whoever have been going out doing missions and that they've come back to Wakanda.
Right. So, and you know, and maybe Black Panther's like, you've changed, Steve Rogers.
You have a beard now.
Yeah, it's like, you're not the man I once knew. Now you must face me in trial by combat.
Or what if T'Challa just like is really, he's like, who are you? I'm Steve. Steve does not have a beard.
Then there's Dormilaje just stabbing him to death.
Yes, they just stabbed him to death.
Yeah. I think, I mean, for me, the most fun is the meetings with, like, Peter Quill and Tony Stark. Right.
That was fun. Those two smartasses together would be a lot of fun.
There was a meme going around. Did you see this?
No.
That was, like, just it was a still frame of Stark standing there with, like, not quite rolling his eyes, but that face face.
Yeah.
That was where somebody is, like, he's been talking to, like, Star-Lord for, like, all of 5 minutes or whatever, and he looks like he's already completely done. It's a great freeze frame. You know, and because he is often that fly in the ointment, it's kind of hilarious to see somebody who's that to him.
Yeah, yeah. I can't wait to see all these characters interact. The one thing that worries me a little bit, and it's a minor worry because the Russo brothers allayed a lot of my fears with Civil War, is there's a lot of characters in this.
Yeah.
And I know this will be a longer movie, but still, we're talking about everyone in the Marvel Universe. That is a challenge.
Yeah, right. You want to make sure, like, for the fans, you make sure that nobody gets punked out. Everybody gets at least a scene or of some sort, but it cannot, like, disrupt the overall flow of the story.
But it's literally all the characters from 19 movies, right? Like, everyone is in this.
And introducing, I guess, a couple...
There's a lot of characters.
Now, it could be as simple as, like, you know, like, four or five people could be introduced as, like, you know, what's going on with your, you know, covert strike team, Cap? Well, and then quick cut to them in action. They get a couple of quick, cool action scenes.
Yeah.
And they get taken out by Thanos or his troops or whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, it could be as brief, you know, like, some people might get scenes that are really just that much.
Yeah. It's a challenge. It's to handle that many characters.
We also get to see the Black Order a little bit more in this trailer.
There's a glimpse of them.
What's that?
It's Thanos' group.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we're worried will be the kind of boring automatons.
I'm not worried about it.
They are not. Here's the thing about the Black Order. They're not automatons. They're not robots. They're actual people.
They're just boring.
I just meant that they're going to be like...
See, here's the thing.
They're going
to
be...
Yes. You like to poke me with that because it's Jonathan Hickman and I like it and you don't.
Yes.
But I think those characters in the hands of the Russo brothers will make you like them.
I actually agree with that. Versions bore the crap out of me.
Yeah, I know.
Are they... Is it like a legion of people? Or is it like just a small group?
There are five individuals who have devoted themselves to Thanos.
Yeah, it's a small group.
So what we're talking in, like, if I were to talk about this in video game terms, is five sub-bosses?
Yes.
Okay.
But five sub-bosses who mimic sort of Avengers power type.
Okay.
They work as an anti-Avengers team. It's a good idea. And, like, yeah, the Russos were going to take... I mean, I hate the Civil War comic, too.
I know.
The Russos are
going to
take what I don't like in the comics and take the potential of it and make it good. So I'm excited to see what they do with Black Order, even though I never, ever want to see Black Order in the movie screen.
Right. I don't think I ever thought we would see them, but I'm curious.
We still haven't talked about Cap catching Thanos' punch.
Yep.
With both hands,
yeah.
Doesn't seem to be going well for him, though.
No, but, like, it looks... they, you know, in the brief moment that they show it in the trailer, it captures a lot of intensity.
Yeah.
And it reflects a, you know, a famous scene from the comic where with Thanos facing off with Cap.
Yep.
Basically... that's the kind of signifier, like, you know how we talked about how that Venom trailer failed so badly?
Yeah, yeah.
This is the kind of thing where it's like, it's not the exact scene from the comic, but it was a clear reflection of it. It's something that fans know well, and even if you don't, even if you're not a comic fan,
it's
a super intense scene of, like, one of the most iconic characters, a guy who is relatively low power in the big scheme of things, taking on the most powerful bad guy they're ever going to have.
Yeah.
And so it looks cool as fuck.
Yeah.
And
that's what Marvel does so well. They know to... anyone can signal to the fans. Anyone can do fan service.
Yeah.
But if you can do fan service, like Dave said, at the same time you're reaching the casual audience...
Right, it's meaningful to the casual audience, too, because they care about Cap now. And they understand, at least you can tell from the trailer, that Thanos is going to be an epic-level bad guy.
Yeah.
And I feel like, from the trailer, it seems like we're going to get a lot of backstory for Thanos. Mm-hmm. And they're actually going to go out of their way of making him a character instead of... Yeah. Just, like, one of their villains.
Well, we see him with Kid Gamora.
Yeah, with
That looked interesting. I actually even like how that scene where... I guess Gamora's talking to... who's she talking to when she
Gamora
names him?
Is it Gamora or Gamora? I always thought it was Gamora.
It's Gamora. Gamora's the turtle.
But yeah, Gamora's the turtle.
It all the time.
Yeah, I do the same thing.
Gamora is correct. But
Gamora.
She's talking to somebody.
Right. It's Peter Quill or Cap or somebody.
No, she's talking to Iron Man.
Iron Man.
Right.
Because he says, what's his name again?
Right. And I actually liked the delivery on that. She says it kind of casually, like Thanos. But she kind of, but there's, like, still some weight to it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, like, a perfect tone. Because it could have been, like, kind of almost too dire, like, they call him Thanos.
Yeah.
And then it would have come off cheesy, so they found that right tone.
Yep.
So here's a weird thing, just weird speculation. Has Tony already seen Thanos because of that little dream sequence?
No, he didn't see Thanos.
He just saw his forces, right?
He saw the forces, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in Age of Ultron, he got a flash forward to all this.
Because everyone got little flash forwards, except for, like, Cap and Black Widow, but, you know, Thor and Iron Man did.
Yeah.
And, I just had to remind myself if he actually saw Thanos, because he saw all of his dead friends.
He did not. What's interesting is, you think about it, Thanos has been in several movies already.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's in Guardians. He was in the end of Avengers. And I feel like he was in... I mean, he had a teaser at the end of something else.
Yeah. Even casuals will have kind of gotten used to his face.
Yeah.
His ugly mug. His
big purple face.
I will say this. There is something about his presence that is not as... scary or kind of intense as I feel like it should be.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to sell that in the movie.
It's maybe a touch too CG. Maybe they almost made him too emotive and he needed to look more alien. I'm not quite sure what it is, but...
I actually agree with you, but I think part of that is they probably haven't finished the effects and everything, you know. But I think it'll work in the context of it. The other thing I want to mention before we get off this is... the Russo brothers, I don't know who's running their Facebook account, but I love whoever it is, because they posted the like hashtag who has the Soul Stone or where's the Soul Stone.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's good. You get people thinking about that. And then they posted the picture, and it was like one of those kid pictures. It's like Thanos' big hand and Gamora's little one. It's like her kid hand and hand hand. There's like little teasers of, like, you know, nothing is spoilery, but little, hey, here it's coming. Hey, get excited.
Right.
They're doing a good job
they're
of keeping
really smart
the interest
about it.
Stoked. We've got our tickets.
Yep.
And I do not want to wait a whole month and a half. I mean, it's basically 2 months, right?
I'm basically seeing it back-to-back. I'm seeing it Thursday and Friday.
I guess, we're about
hopefully
6 weeks out.
Hopefully it doesn't stink.
I don't think there's the potential for that.
By the way, I also have to mention... their little capper with Spider-Man and Doctor Strange.
Great.
Very funny.
Yeah.
The brief shot of Spider-Man, like, web-swinging through debris on, like, that epic level. Pretty cool looking, too.
I love their take on the Iron Spider costume.
It looks pretty good. The traditionalist in me is, like, Peter's way too young to be going through, like, that many tech versions of his suit.
Sure.
But... they made it work in the movie context.
Peter is sort of an underling of Stark,
Yeah.
Not underling, but, you know,
a part of
Kind of.
Well, I think that's the thing that, that
honestly,
Dave
I feel
I
like they
are...
did it as well as they possibly could.
Yeah.
I still don't love it as a concept, but there's no doubt that they found a way to make it work.
That's where I am too.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily love it, but if this is the way you do it in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I'm okay with it.
Right. I've seen a lot of different versions of Spider-Man over the years. I can't get too offended.
Yep. Charlie's Angels is coming to comics.
Right.
So
by creator, you wouldn't ever
it's
think.
It's a classic Charlie's Angels, 70s Charlie's Angels. It's by John Layman and Joe Eisma. And if you had told me there was a creative team that made me interested in the Charlie's Angels comic, I would have thought you were crazy. But I'll read that. That sounds like fun.
I have a fondness for the Charlie's Angels property to begin with. I mean, the movie did such a great job of selling that.
The old show was kind of a weird mixture of like kind of like quasi serious detective-y stuff.
Yeah.
With you know inevitably like oh we have to go undercover at the Playboy Bunny Club or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, I watched the reruns. I mean,
yeah, I semi watched it. I think I've seen enough to have a sense of it. But
I think Layman will come up with some interesting ideas. And
do you think they're going to play it straight, or are they going to like slightly like you know the movie's kind of I'm going to say way camped and stylized it up?
Yeah, although they were pretty straight, they were sincere about it too.
I feel like
but they like threw in like it was almost you could tell McGee the director came out of music videos,
yeah,
and they had like really larger than life stuff like the Thin Man villain, which was awesome.
Well, Layman wrote a comic called Bay City Jive that was a 70s riff, and it was pretty, I mean, it was a riff on 70s stuff, but it was also straightforward. Yeah. I would expect the same tone here. Like, it'll be funny. Layman does funny really well.
You know
but
how,
it won't sell out the characters.
Right. You know how, like, the Shaft comic really had very strong writing for it? Is David Walker?
David Walker, yeah.
And I feel like you don't want like a super well-written Charlie's Angels. That'd be kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
But they could actually tighten up some of the dialogue. I mean, you know, the dialogue actually could be a bit stronger than it, say, was on the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could have decent, you know, mysteries plotted out. Or you could veer a little bit more campy with it. I'll be curious to see what direction they go.
Yeah. The big announcement of Justice League number 1, which is coming out in June, is Scott Snyder is writing with Jim Chung on art. Jim Chung said this is like his first DC work in like 20 years.
Yeah.
That is a powerhouse creative team because Jim Chung has gotten like really good.
He's legendary level good, yeah. The other thing that's interesting is the team, the Justice League team, which is basically the Justice League animated team, the initial seven, plus Cyborg and Aquaman.
So we got Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman,
Hawkgirl, John Stewart.
As Green Lantern,
and Martian Manhunter.
Martian Manhunter. Is that six? Am I missing somebody?
I don't know.
Anyway. Flash.
And Flash, yeah. And then Aquaman and Cyborg, so they added the movie characters. But essentially, it's a mix of, like, the Justice League everybody knows.
Yeah.
And he's already played around with those characters a little bit. Even before he did Dark Knight's Metal, there was, like, a Batman story with the League in it.
I mean, it's a smart move. Snyder has such a following, and putting him on their sort of tentpole book makes a hell of a lot of sense.
They haven't had anybody like big on Justice League for a while.
Not to be besmirching, but I mean Brian Hitch has been writing Justice League since the beginning of Rebirth, and
you can besmirch him.
Yeah, this is a safe space to besmirch Brian Hitch.
I never understood why they put him on that book. It doesn't make sense.
Well, I'm sure that they were like in the kind of dumbest way. He made Ultimates. They effectively an
as
Avengers
the artist.
Book.
Yeah, he
as
drew
the artist.
It.
Yeah. But he was also drawing this to start with.
If they put Mark Miller on it at the beginning, that would have been something
big. Yeah, I
don't love
it, but it would have made sense.
See, that's the thing. Rebirth had a big, big push to make artists writers. There was a lot of that going on. New 52 did too. They were doing a big push for artists for writers.
Arguably still going on right now with the spinoffs of Dark Knight's Metal.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't think DC is exactly abandoning that.
Yeah.
But they do recognize that, you know, Snyder is, like, as big as it gets for as far as their writers right now.
Yeah.
Bendis is going to, like, come along and they're going to have to fight.
I do think the thing is that
Bendis is a team player.
He is.
One of the biggest things about Grant Morrison doing Justice League was that he was doing the Big Seven.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to a team that is sort of a classic team that they're not bringing in, you know, a lot of different characters and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a little too bad because you do lose the diversity. That's one of the reasons that Hawkgirl and Green Lantern and John Stewart were in the animated cartoon.
Yeah.
Was it like we wanted a little bit of diversity?
Yeah.
And so bringing in Cyborg a little bit adds to that. And that's the downside of using the Big Seven is the Big Seven is pretty white bread.
Yeah.
A
little bit.
But so they tweaked it a little bit. But there's a reason they're sort of iconic, and I understand why they're doing it.
Right. But they also are, I mean, they do still have, so gender diversity, you still will get Hawkwoman, and yep. you still will get Jon Stewart, too.
Yeah.
And Jon Stewart is one of those where, you know, once the cartoon kind of made it big, it was kind of funny in the store. You know, I grew up with Hal, and then to some degree Kyle.
Yeah.
But kids who kind of came in on the animated series, which was doubtless seen by many more people
yeah.
than read the comics.
Yep.
We're surprised. They were like, and they would come in the store and they'd be like, why is Green Lantern white?
Yeah, there was like, who's this white Green Lantern?
Yeah. And so having a big flagship Justice League, which they're going to probably try and sell to as wide a variety of people as they can, who is going to have the characters that kids will have grown up with,
yep.
is a smart idea.
So if this works, they should do the same thing with Teen Titans next.
They really should.
Yeah.
Incidentally, I don't know though if that Snyder has a writing style. He's such a writer's writer kind of
yeah.
person that would particularly appeal to kids. He does do action scenes and stuff like that, and but I still feel in some way like I don't know if it's like kid friendly.
Right.
Right. Well, I mean, there're definitely mature themes and stuff. Court of Owls is very dark.
Yeah.
For what it is. But,
and even like the kind of wilder Dark Knight's Metal is also a.
But that's more kind of. Insanity. I could
right.
see more kids being into that because of just the...
But I think kids kind of want a more straightforward blend. Like, they
well,
want, like...
It depends on what you guys mean by kids, because if we're talking, like, the teenagers...
Yeah,
it's like, perfect.
They look how many people have bought Metal. Look how many people have come in on Rebirth. Look how many people bought the Court of Owls run on Batman. Like,
yeah.
And it's a lot of younger readers who come in
yeah.
for it. I think that the thing Dave, you and I have talked about numerous times is that kids don't want kid comics.
Right. And that's certainly not what I'm thinking of. I just think, like more traditionally linear. Snyder is a more experimental writer.
Yeah. I think there's something, too. I think that in the same way that when you're younger, you first discover Alan Moore and Watchmen and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You even if you're not quite ready for it, you want to be ready for it.
It's true.
So I think that it will work on a wider basis than
you've got to evolve your mental faculties
yeah,
to adjust to it.
And I would imagine Snyder's going to bring something different to Justice League.
Probably
just
so.
In the same way that he created the Court of Owls and gave this more mythos style to Batman. Mm-hmm. He'll probably do something in the same vein for Justice League, and
yeah.
I honestly think it needs it.
I'm curious. I don't know what a great Justice League book looks like now.
No,
Justice League is kind of like
been a long time.
It's one of these books. We were talking about this with another character the other day about that I've sort of had my perfect version in it, so you can't do another version. I don't know what character it was. We were talking about it on Sunday.
Oh yeah.
That there's some characters that like
Hawkworld.
It was Hawkworld. We were talking
yeah.
about Hawkman,
yeah.
and I was like
the difficulty with finding a vision that works. For
no one's gonna be able to do a Hawkman that's better than Hawkworld for me, or as good as.
I think that's probably.
And Justice League, while there's art issues with it, Morrison's Justice League is kind of what I want out of Justice League.
Yeah.
And so, even though it's not like an amazing run, someone could do a better Justice League for me, but it's got to be better than that for me to be interested. I'm not
Morrison
sure.
Morrison was
that.
Pretty good at the high point stuff.
Yeah.
And there's like, I feel like I could name a dozen amazing sequences
moments.
From
yeah.
there.
Well, it's like we're always talking about the movies. Like, they get how you get the cool moments.
Yep.
And Justice League had that.
Yep.
So, I hope that he can do it. I would really like to fall in love with the Justice League again. Close out from one of the bigger launches to probably the smallest launch no one will even notice, but it's kind of interesting. Dazzler is getting a one-shot called Dazzler X Song. It is set in the New York punk scene. It's by Magdalene Visaggio, who does Kim and Kim. Art by Laura Braga, who's worked on
like
Iron Man.
The contemporary punk scene or like a kind of a retro 70s
version? I don't really know.
I think it's more contemporary because I believe it was Bendis who did sort of a redo of Dazzler
yeah.
recently.
And
kind of changed her
yeah,
musical
right.
influences and stuff. So
yeah.
she definitely looked
I mean,
punk.
It sort of makes sense unless you are deliberately trying to do like, you know, like a Luke Cage comic set in the 70s and a Dazzler set in
yeah.
the 70s.
Yeah.
Which I would be interested in, by the way.
Yeah,
yeah
I would definitely read
Marvel,
that.
Get on that a, like, call
new,
it like...
New
Marvel,
Frontier style?
Yeah, Marvel 1970s, whatever, yeah. Call it Bronze Age, whatever you want to call it, but dig up, you know, Moon Knight and the
Marvel Secret Disco.
Yes, I want a serious version of this and not a campy version. But
it has to be called Secret Something. That's Marvel's thing. It's like DC. It's called Infinite Something.
No,
it's something Crisis.
But anyway, so they're doing this presumably a contemporary kind of spin on Dazzler, and it's a one shot.
It's the one shot. Yeah.
Okay, but yeah, that's pretty notable. You know, getting somebody kind of from a. I don't know, I'm not going to say underground comic, but an edgier comic.
Yeah.
Well,
like
it's also
Kim
probably,
Kim.
I mean, not a test, but it's just to see if that goes well, and she'll
yeah.
probably,
yep.
they'll
yeah.
get probably more work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do always like when Marvel and DC find interesting voices from outside. They're kind of house style, you know, superhero dorks.
Yeah.
We'll see if Kim and Kim Rider is a fit.
Yeah. All right. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about comics for the week.
One familiar cry.
We were talking comics for the week of Wednesday, March 21st, and Nick, why don't you start us off?
Sure. My pick is The Mighty Thor, number 705.
Big stuff happens.
People have been talking about this comic.
Well, this is the penultimate issue before the end of the Jane Foster era of Thor. There are some flashbacks to when she first got the hammer. Who knew about it? There's a wonderful scene with her and Heimdall that I thought was very poignant and kind of sad, but it made a lot of sense. And just, I like Heimdall, so. But this is her versus the Mangog, which is the destroyer of all things gods. He's destroying
I was just
Asgardia.
Flipping through it a little bit, and she was, her like internal monologue, she was talking about like some of the foes she's faced. Like really dangerous, like the destroyer armor and other high level stuff, and sort of making out that the Mangog's like sort of the intensity of, like, I don't know if it was the evil or whatever about him, or his destructive nature or whatever, was
it's
like
the destructive nature
was a level that is beyond anything, like beyond even like god level.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, she's gone up against all of the major Thor foes.
Right,
I mean, be it Malekith to, you know, the destroyer armor to
some frost giant jerkwads.
She's fought, yeah, all the...
That actually, I think, was how it started.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. To the evilness of Roxxon. But made a lot of friends along the way, and they've fleshed out people like Freya and Thor as Odin's son. And, yeah, and this is sort of just, honestly, a big action piece of her fighting this guy, or this god who's killing everyone. And trying to save Asgard. And
is that, is Mangog trying to destroy Asgard specifically?
And kill everyone. Because basically he's the wrath of the people who the gods don't answer to. Their prayers don't answer, don't get answered, and he's sort of the wrath of...
I'm kind of getting behind this
Mangog.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's there to kill Odin.
Hashtag Team Mangog.
Odin and Freya and Thor and... I don't want to get into it too much more than that, because there are some
big stuff is going to happen here.
Yeah, but like I said, this is a giant action piece, and it's sort of a great thing for Russell Dodderman just to show his skill of storytelling.
He's been on that book for a while, huh?
Yeah, he and Jason Aaron have been doing this for a long time, and Jason Aaron is going to continue after the Jane Foster era and doing Thor again. I forget who's doing the art in it at that point, but I know it was somebody good. I will continue on to see what Russell Dodderman does, because he's an amazing artist. But honestly, if you haven't been reading Thor, check it out. It's just really good storytelling.
But probably not with this issue.
Probably not with this issue, but there are a lot of trades.
Yeah.
I think there are several volumes, like 4 or 5 of the Jane Foster stuff. And start at the beginning and...
Well, you know, the amount of people who've been showing interest in it, I think it's very easy to jump back and actually read this full run.
Yeah.
And as interested as people are, they should probably do that.
Yep.
Yeah.
You're such a fan.
But it's just a rewarding story, because it is sort of this journey for Jane Foster from, you know, this woman to being this god to finding... who she is at her core.
It's not too often you get such a kind of like a complete story like that. Like, we presume that there will be some manner of her end during this. Obviously, don't spoil anything.
No,
but
I'm
like,
not.
We know that her time with Thor is coming to an end. That her that she was dying, and so she's probably going to come to an end. To get 6 volumes or whatever that chronicle that full storyline is pretty amazing.
Yeah. So yes. Read these books. Read this story.
Dave?
I have... my number one pick this week is Runaways number 7.
Mm-hmm.
We've picked Runaways probably every issue. What's the author's name?
Rainbow Rowell.
Rainbow Rowell.
Yep.
That cannot be a real name unless she's the child of hippies.
She could be a child of hippies.
It's completely possible that she's the child of hippies.
Yeah.
But no matter what... We have endless superlatives for her grasp of the characters.
Yep.
And by the way, I just have to quick say, I'm looking at this cover, and the more I look at it, the funnier it becomes to me, because it's like a portrait of them, like a family portrait.
Mm-hmm.
And every character is so in character, it's amazing. First of all, Old Lace, their velociraptor, has this kind of quizzical look, like what, like the flashbulb just went off, and it's just like, what?
You know what, I have to say one thing.
Yeah?
Chris Anka has given, and I love Adrian Alfano, who created The Runaways with Macron. Chris Anka,
one of your favorite artists.
Chris Anka is the best person to ever draw Old Lace. He's given her a personality that she's never had.
And then, so also in this picture, we have Molly with her traditional exuberance.
Yep.
Gert looking completely unhappy with the picture, which completely fits her. I even noticed that with the almost sort of like ironic look to, why can't I suddenly say her name?
Nico.
But she's got her hand on the shoulder of Carolina, who's kind of got her hand up there covering
it. Right.
And then you have the sort of very forced fake grin from Chase in the background as he tries to fulfill the sort of father role, which ends up being a thing in the story.
Yep.
But that is just an awesome cover, and it's funny funnier the more I look at it.
Yep.
Randy, we were talking off mic earlier that this is kind of a low-stakes comic.
Yep.
Other than the last issue or two of the first six-issue story arc,
right?
There was not a whole lot of action to it, and yet it felt so wholly like a Runaways comic.
Oh, yeah.
And like I was just completely... Every scene was amazing. And this is another one of those issues that is a low-stakes issue. It probably reads more like a YA novel between these sort of, you know... sort of adventure-y or moments that might be for the characters might go through. Here they've gotten together, and where is it they're staying?
It's their old hostel.
Okay,
their place underneath the Hollywood sign.
Their former base.
Yep.
And they're kind of all just kind of they're getting back in the swing of things, but they're also falling into a little bit of routine. Like for instance, Molly is going back to junior high.
Mm-hmm.
And just as an example of some of the strong writing on it, she's going back and she's like. She's got a new best friend there, and it's weird because like they mentioned that as the runaways to her are they're basically like family,
yeah.
And they're like she's so close with them that they almost can't be best friends to her, and so she hasn't had a best friend in ages. And I thought that was a really like keen sort of insight
mm-hmm.
because you would think, oh no, like her best friend is Gert or her best friend is Nico or whatever,
right?
But it's like no, they've like been through too much. It's like it is like family. And they kind of check in on everybody. So just a few of the interesting things going on. Chase is actually trying to go from being the sort of the doofus to the guy, the old elder statesman of them, which is to say he's trying to tie a tie and get a job, and he can't tie a tie. And
tying a tie is hard.
It is hard. I'm with that's I've never felt so close to Chase as that moment. let's see.
Rainbow Rowell does the mundane very, very well.
Yeah, that's one of the like. There's just like there's a whole lot of these characters talking, and it's all interesting to me. They have to figure out a way for Molly to have parents or guardians to take care of them, and they're like, well, the runaways are generally too young to even pretend at that. But they're like, well, what if Nico used a spell to do it?
But I mean, at this point, Chase is supposed to be how old? He's like 24?
Somewhere not that old.
Is it not old? Wouldn't it be like 20 or something?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe.
He might be like 18 or 19. Yeah. It's not that old.
Mostly characters only age when the writers want them to.
Yeah.
And the Runaways have definitely aged a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
But like, if we go by Molly, she was probably like in 6th grade and now she's like in 8th grade or something.
Yeah, well, she was supposed to be 10 and now she's like 13.
Okay,
so it's been like 3 years.
Yeah. There's a great scene. So among other things in this, there's a really interesting conversation between Carolina and Nico, where they kind of talk about their initial differences and how their friendship sort of deepened in a way. And it's the writing on that I thought was superb. Aside from the dialogue being good, the way that they go from being kind of like slightly rivals from the different sides of the tracks to kind of deeper friends was very, very well expressed, I guess I'd say.
This is the post-Fallen Runaways I wanted, and I understand why it's kind of a very niche
it's also
book.
And it's the one that he couldn't have written.
No, he couldn't have written this.
There was also a great scene where the robotic head of Victor, he's recognizing that his hair is getting a little bit unkempt.
Yeah.
and Gert agrees to give him a haircut. And there is a hilarious conversation while she's cutting his hair.
Yeah.
And as it, with everything else, it's not just funny. It is, like, there's some depth to it.
You know what's interesting about this? This is like an indie comic.
Yeah.
It's all character-based. It's all... It's so good, but it's... I understand why it's a hard sell.
Sure. Well, you know, as a kid, every once in a while, I'd be reading one of those X-Men baseball games or whatever, and I'd be like, I wish I could get a little bit more of this.
Yeah.
Or I wish, you know, they'd do a page or two of downtime, and I'd be like, I kind of wish I could get some more of this. I understand, you kind of can't do that easily in the X-Men without compromising it and turning into something different. Runaways, I feel like, is more adaptable to it.
Yeah.
And maybe I would only say that with writing this good.
Yeah.
Because I could see that, like, almost anybody else doing this, I would have been like... could they please run into Dr. Doom?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But here, I don't feel that pressure at all.
I feel like this book is, unfortunately, it's in that weird middle ground. Like, the superhero fans are going to pick it up, and it's not enough punching, not enough superhero-y stuff.
Right.
And the indie people are never going to look at it because it looks like a superhero book.
Right.
Which is too bad, because I think it really
the
is.
The best
like,
case...
It's such a good book.
The best case scenario is probably just to people who have already read Runaways, which everybody should have read and liked.
Yep.
And this is the only follow-up you need to that initial, those initial two volumes by Vaughn.
Agreed.
Randy, what's your pick?
All right. So I should start off by saying that my general picks, I'm probably not going to pick my favorite, like, Miss Marvel, Runaways, all that kind of stuff. I'm trying to get something new this week.
Oh, yeah. So if somebody just picked Runaways again, it's kind of a screw-up.
I'm just saying.
They're just like, oh, we've been down this path before.
No, you didn't find anything new that you liked as much.
Yeah, that's true.
I found stuff I liked, but I'm not saying these are better than my favorites.
Right.
But
they deserve a spotlight.
They deserve a spotlight. And so I'm going to talk about Pathfinder Spiral of Bones, number one. So this is... Pathfinder's been doing a series of miniseries. I've been buying them all in hardcovers. They're slowly coming out in trades, but the second trade is out this week. And what's interesting to me is that Pathfinder is doing a thing... They're basically... They've got like a little shared universe, and the stories refer to one another. So
you're talking about like when they had like... Do you mean the where there was like crossovers from other properties?
No. I'm talking about I'm a shared universe in Pathfinder. So okay. Pathfinder, D&D has sort of gone in this direction. This is sort of a meta conversation about gaming.
Yeah.
So D&D has gone in this direction that makes a lot of sense, where they don't have iconic characters. Like they don't have they've downplayed Elminster and Drizzt and all those guys in the favor of your players' characters. Those are the heroes. Those are the guys you sort of.
Although they do have Boo and Minsk.
But even that, like, I'm talking about in the game.
Oh,
in
okay.
In the game itself.
Yes.
There's not, like, iconic D&D characters. They're not playing that up. Your characters are the stars of that universe, which makes sense for a role-playing game.
Right.
Pathfinder has built a world where every character has an iconic version. So, like, to demonstrate every new class, whether it's the Gunslinger, the Alchemist, there's a character they build around it.
Right, and, like, famously, like, their fighter guy, Valoros, right?
Yep.
Like, if you played the demo boxed set, which is a really good box set, you probably played Valoros in there. And he is a quintessential fighter and a little bit of a drinker guy. Right. And
Well, that's what I think is interesting, is Pathfinder has built this thing. People play and make their characters, but there's definitely a world here that is based on what the designers have come up with. They have ideas for what these cities do and what this world looks like. And so what they've been doing as they do these Pathfinder comics is they've been deepening these relationships. So Valoros in here, this Spiral of Bones has a run-in with a half-orc, their Inquisitor, which is a pretty weird class.
Uh-huh.
She's a half-orc, and she and Valoros have sort of this bro-y relationship where they also sleep together.
Okay.
Which you don't see a lot of sex in D&D comics.
Right.
But they get
together. Pathfinder always had it to, reading up on some of the settings, a little bit more edge to it and some of their adventures.
There's a whole thing here basically where Valoros and this Inquisitor, whose name I can't pronounce, get together and basically just have sort of casual sex together in the inn, which the thief is complaining about in the morning because she kept them up all night. And little moments like that. The thief, Maricel, is an elf, and she is in a relationship with the wizard, the cleric, who is not in this book because she's off on a pilgrimage. Right. And they're sort of talking about that. And little things like all these interactions between the characters are
pushing a little bit against the kind of very standard kind of sometimes boring tropes of fantasy.
Yeah. Well, my point is that this is the characters are all interacting with one another. They've got this big cast of characters. They've interacted like the Alchemist was in at one point. They introduce all these characters. They show them off, and then they'll draw back to new adventures. So this issue has their wizard and their ranger stuck underground and having to call for help. He's lost his spellbook, and At the same time, Valorous is running into his Inquisitor buddy. The sorcerer and the elf are sort of interacting. And then there's a big fight with what look like sort of... They're not gargoyles. They're maybe almost like these cloakers.
Okay.
Like weird D&D monsters. So this is
sounding a little bit like the sort of the way the Marvel Universe functions in the movies, where you get to like, oh, cool, we get to see these two characters together for a while, or what would it be like if Star-Lord met Tony Stark, yeah. And, you know, but with fantasy, their fantasy arcs.
Exactly that. I mean, the other thing is this does the thing that the D&D comics did in the 90s I really like, where when the Inquisitor uses her powers... She, you know, speaks a thing to Desna, her god, and then fires this cool magic arrow, and you sort of see the powers and the spells being used. So right. this gives you a sense of what is cool about Pathfinder, and I think that's really interesting. While I like the D&D comics, they're doing a different thing. I think a lot of people who are playing Pathfinder would love these comics, but I think nobody really looks at them.
Right.
But they're fantastic. If you ever want a good D&D comics. This is really good. And the reason I picked up and read this one, I usually wait for the collections. The reason I read this one as a single issue is because it also has a 4-page backup Starfinder story. Which I really love the Starfinder world, and their iconics aren't as well established yet, and so I was really curious to see what they do. It's little 4 pages, there's not much to it, but it's fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of it, and I'm hoping they'll do a full-on Starfinder comic.
You know, I suspect some people probably think sort of the based on like maybe the tradition of like how video games have worked, when you adapt them to comics, usually video game adaptations are pretty mediocre at best.
Yeah.
But there's actually a surprisingly decent tradition of D&D comics, like even going back to the old DC ones from the late 80s or whatever, they were already interesting and solid from the get-go, and they've had several high points since then.
Yeah.
And Pathfinder, the Pathfinder comics have been good too, so... So, weirdly, the tabletop gaming comics seem to be pretty good, and people probably should give those a chance.
Well, it doesn't seem weird to me at all, because the thing about fiction is, when you get something that's got a really well-developed Bible behind it, you know, most TV shows have that, you usually get these really interesting stories because you're getting the tip of the iceberg. There's so much beneath it, there's a lot to support the story. Gaming has the deepest storytelling and world-building of anything.
Right.
There are books upon books detailing this world. So we're getting a little tip of the iceberg in the story, but that means it's well supported underneath, and you can tell that when a good writer gets their hands on it. Pathfinder comics have had good writers. It's really interesting. I think people should give these a shot. And even if you don't want to go in the single issue route, there are the trade paperbacks. I definitely recommend them. I've read all of them.
Mm-hmm.
My backup pick, another one. This is a bit of a hard sell. Usagi Yojimbo, which is a long, long running comic, is finally getting a new number one. He's doing a mini series here called The Hidden. And there's not been a Usagi number one in a long, long time. It was always sort of accessible, but I think people saw the big issue numbers
right.
And the black and white art and were kind of put off by it.
Yeah. Although everybody who's ever read it is like, oh my god, this comic is amazing.
Because this comic's amazing.
Yeah.
So this one starts off with a couple of riders riding into town. They're being pursued. We don't know exactly what's going on. And it basically eventually drags in Usagi, the running Ronin, as well as a well-known character, his Inspector Ishida. And there's a mystery. There's also a thief who's coming. So if you've been reading Usagi, there's a lot of familiar characters here. If you've not, they're all very interestingly established, iconic characters, you know.
I really like the Inspector guy.
The Inspector, a thief, a Ronin, and then the sort of mysterious mercenaries. And it ties into a real-life historical thing that was going on in Japan in a very interesting way. Even though this is not historical Japan, it's based very heavily on that. Because Sakai is Japanese and knows a lot of that history.
Yeah, the comic has always aimed to do action-adventure, but framed in real historical elements.
So if you've never read Usagi, this is a good place to start, and it's just a fantastic first issue.
You know what I found interesting over the years? Because I came in, it was specifically issue 37, mm-hmm. was the first issue I ever read of the series. And I still love that issue to this day. It was a random issue completely, maybe even a second part of a story, and I completely got what was going on and instantly liked it.
Hmm.
And it's one of those weird books where, even this far into it, he has always made it approachable.
Yeah. Dave, what's your backup pick?
My backup pick is kind of an oddball one for me, although I've picked a few other issues of this. The DC comic Future Quest, that was the one where they, kind of with a rotating cast of the heroes from the old Hanna-Barbera stuff, but it was the one that had Johnny Quest, Space Ghost, the Herculoids, and all mm-hmm. that.
Yep.
And they've occasionally like zeroed in on these characters that I don't even know, even by name. This one, Mitor. That's like Mighty, but like if it was a He-Man name,
yep.
character name,
yep.
Mitor. But it's pretty easy to pick up on the concept. And what I like about these books is that they remind me of the kind of the straightforward but well-written action-adventure comics kind of my youth. A very good Bronze Age comic. In this case, Mitor is a little bit of a Thor kind of concept. In this, there is a kid who's been helping him out in previous storylines when they teamed up with all the characters. He's a young African-American kid, and he gains this power what had been like this, basically like a super-powered caveman.
Okay.
Who had this like club that was like, think Thor's hammer. It's like makes him super strong, can do blasts and stuff. You know, like when you look at like the Herculoids and stuff, you're like, okay, that was this weird combination of they were like almost their own, like they were primitives, but they had giant ants, you know, dinosaur pets, and they had like a slingshot that shot like energy.
Yep. And their dinosaurs could fire things out of their trunks.
Clearly, the Hanna-Barbera cartoons of the late 60s and 70s were not too worried about like realism.
There was a little bit of drug use going on in Hanna-Barbera Studios. Let's just say.
A super-powered caveman with a magical club is not the weirdest thing. And Basically, that's what this kid's got. And it's his birthday in this one, so he's hanging out with his family, and there's some kind of fun stuff just with his family. But one of the chicks who's like think almost like Black Widow, I think one of the maybe original characters that they were introduced to kind of find ways to kind of have like a world security force, think, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. type stuff. She's like the representative of that, and she like comes and she's like, hey, we need your help. We need Mitor. And like his parents know about it and they're like, it's cool. And it's like there's a part of me that's like, man, this is very awesome. This like it'd be like Black Widow coming to say, hey, we need you on an adventure, and your parents are okay with it. And what has happened is there's actually kind of a cool story where an alien civilization has landed in Switzerland. They were looking for the highest tech on the planet, and they find the Super Collider, the Hadron Super Collider, and they're there to meet the representatives of this powerful technology, which they think we're about to become spacefaring, but they are a conquering type of race, and so they have their super kind of dangerous emissary down there, and Mitor goes up to take him on and kind of talk him down, and also with the help of the agent who I can't remember her name. I don't know if she has she doesn't have a name as cool as Mitor.
So what, who cares?
The alien at one point says, you wield a club? Does this just disjointed world still use Stone Age implements? And the kid, now, you know, turned into this giant caveman type guy, is like, nope, just me. You can go back to your Starpoint boys and tell them Earth says no. Message delivered by Mitor, as he knocks the crap out of him with like a cosmic club. It is not the end of the alien, because he's got all kinds of cool high-tech stuff going on. But, like, the way he ends up fighting him, it is not just a, well, eventually I will beat him down. They have to kind of come up with a clever plan to remove him from his sources of power. They have to do some strategizing that's pretty cool. But it is a big, cool action-adventure kind of wish-fulfillment comic that reminds me, like I say, of the best of sort of Bronze Age adventure comics, the kind of Roger Stern Spider-Man comics era, mm-hmm. and Larry Hama, G.I. Joe. Those kind of, it made me want to revisit all of the Future Quest. I picked up the first volume, and I'll probably follow up the second one. Oh, I forgot to even mention Steve Lieber.
I was going to say, who's the artist? The artists are amazing.
Yeah, and Steve Lieber draws a badass, what do you call it, Super Collider and the big radar dish there.
Oh, okay.
So, Jeff Parker continues to write this. He's been on board since the beginning, and this sort of, I'm going to say modernist Bronze Age is kind of what he's good at.
Yeah.
And then Steve, they always get good artists, so there's been like Steve Rude, who was originally doing it?
It was,
Evan Shaner.
Evan Shaner.
I was going to say it's all Steves, but Evan
Shaner. Yeah. And now Steve Lieber, who's a super talented artist. Yeah. I don't know if they've gotten Samney in there, but he would be a good fit. Yeah. Any of those kind of clean line artists. I like all of these characters, even like the people who like you only know is kind of like the ridiculous spoof characters like Birdman. Mm-hmm. They made him really cool in the previous issues I've read, as well as the guys that, you know, everybody kind of knows, like Space Ghost or the Herculoids.
Right.
I'm feeling this comic. Want to definitely pick up the other volumes in the series.
All right. Nick, your other pick?
My other pick is Cable number 155. Which is a new jumping on point for the book. A new writer, I guess, writers.
Writer.
Yes, Zach and Thompson and Lonnie.
And alt-right artist.
Yeah, Zach yes. Thompson and Lonnie Nadler come on as the writers, and German Perlotta comes on as the artist. It's just sort of an explanation of who Cable is, a little bit of his backstory, and then sort of jumping into his time-traveling adventures, fighting Nimrod in the future, but also dealing with sort of hope and exploring their relationship as father and daughter, and a threat from Cable's past sort of comes back to haunt him.
He's basically like full-on surrogate father to her.
I mean, basically he
raised her.
He raised her in the future while time hopping.
Hold his hope now?
I mean, 16, 17?
I didn't know Hope was around anymore.
Yeah. No, they've been using her.
Yeah, she's shown up, especially with like the Phoenix stuff. She showed up.
I think I've occasionally mixed her up with Rachel Summers because she's yet another... short-haired redhead.
From the Summers family.
Yeah.
No, she's not telepath. She's a mimic. She can mimic any mutant power that she's around.
Oh, did you just say she can mimic voices?
No. She cannot mimic voices. But, I have a fondness for Cable. This is sort of a solo Cable adventure. No X-Force or no team. Just him and his daughter fighting one of Cable's past enemies. It is not Strife. It's something else. Tying in with
did you say this is the start of a new storyline?
It is. Sort of tying in with his techno-organic virus that's been sort of plaguing him from the beginning. They even mention Slim and Red, which if you remember that miniseries.
Yeah, that's the when Cyclops and Jean went to the future and raised him.
Yep.
Which is weird. So, it is weird.
So if people who are like kind of like getting into Cable based on the like or interested just based on the Deadpool trailers and stuff like that,
I think this
could be
an
issue that they could start with.
Yeah, I think so.
Obviously with issue, what is it, 155. 155. That is your magical Cable issue, people.
Thanks, legacy numbering.
Yeah. by the way, real quick, I have had some confusion among this with customers. Are they going to revert back to number ones when they...
Not with everything, but we don't really know.
Okay, just checking.
Okay, other stuff on my reading pile this week. Damage number 3, which sees the new character go up against Wonder Woman. Kick-Ass number 2, the continuing adventures of the new Kick-Ass.
Mm-hmm.
Thanos number 17, which is the penultimate issue of, I think, Donny Cates' run.
Yeah.
Which is, like, so popular right now, we cannot keep it
on the shelves.
In.
There's a reprint this
even
week.
Even with new printings coming out, people are buying them too much.
But some awesome stuff happens with Silver Surfer, and if you're a Thanos fan, definitely want to read it. Avengers No Surrender Part 11, which I guess is Avengers 685, sees the Red Hulk don an Iron Patriot armor to fight Hulk.
If there's anything the Red Hulk needs, it's armor to make him stronger.
Exactly. and then X-Men Gold, number 24, which I think Dave commented this is Orange is the New Gold.
Yeah, they're all in prison orange.
And it definitely looks like an Orange is the New Black cover.
Yeah.
But this is them in prison going up against other mutants who are in prison. It's interesting. And then there's also the, sort of the side story of a team run by Iceman, which I actually really liked.
Hmm.
But that is all, Dave.
I easily could have been one of my picks because I pick it every time and it's great every time. Killer Be Killed, number 17.
Yep.
This one is set entirely in the it's not an asylum. I don't know that that's right.
It's a mental hospital.
Yeah, it's a mental hospital where he's been institutionalized and he is trying to, in a way, confess to his psychiatrist and tell him that he is the vigilante. But there are problems along the way, and there's something that arises within the hospital itself that leads him to potentially want to make use of the killing skills that he's garnered. But like everything else in the series, nothing is as simple as it seems. There's the first issue of the evolution of Cave Carson has a cybernetic eye as it becomes Cave Carson has an interstellar eye. That's the second, I think, of the, or maybe even third of the DC Young Animal stuff. Third. There was Shade the Changing Woman and something.
Eternity Girl.
And Eternity Girl, yeah. There's the first issue of Weapon H. That's the ongoing series? Miniseries?
Yeah, ongoing.
Ongoing series about the weird creation that has, like, Hulk, the Hulk, and yet with like Wolverine's adamantium and claws.
Yep.
I did not read this yet, but it's written by Greg Pak, who like famously wrote World War Hulk and Planet Hulk, and has knows his way around Hulk stuff.
Yep. The character fights the Wendigo, which is cool.
Right, right. And also, I did get the vibe that he's like he is not like Hulk 24/7. He does transform into a normal person. And that person is sort of like on the run, a little bit like old school Banner style.
Yeah, I was going to say it felt like that.
But it seemed like I got the vibe that he was doing some character work and it was not literally just this guy running around full on Hulk with claws just tearing shit up. People might like that, and I know he does fight the Wendigo, but there's also a character side to it, and I would expect that Greg Pak probably does pretty good with it. And lastly, if you're a fan of like sort of that European art style, like think Meta Barons or Mobius stuff or any of those, there's this new sci-fi book called what is it? Is that Infinity Eight? That's about this kind of a in the European tradition on an alien ship, a sort of sexy special agent chick who's dealing with a weird encounter that they have in like hyperspace and the strange aliens on board. It is kind of typically kind of weird European, but beautifully drawn. It is I thought it was a pretty fun read that people might want to check out, even if only for the artwork. It's pretty stunning. Randy, what else you got?
All right, so Ms. Marvel 28 wraps up the missing Ms. Marvel story finally, and has been really good as always. It's got a nice moment with Ms. Marvel and Captain Marvel. It's a payoff to where they've been since Civil War II.
Is that on the cover? Is that Captain Marvel wearing Ms. Marvel's costume?
Might be.
That's
that does not happen, by the way.
Yeah, I think I believe it's probably symbolic, but...
Tales of Suspense number 103 is the penultimate issue of that, which gives a big revelation as to how Black Widow is alive, why she's alive, what she's been doing, and also guest stars... famous Russian bear, superhero, Ursa Major.
Oh, that actually makes me more interested in
it. I knew it would. This is really good. It's weird. It is sort of surreal for a sort of spy book, but I've been really liking this. I wish Tales of Suspense was an ongoing, because I really like what Rosenberg is doing with Hawkeye, Winter Soldier, and Black Widow.
Can someone remind me, how did Black Widow get killed?
It was during Civil War II.
Evil Steve killed her.
Or Secret Empire.
Okay. Evil Steve, you jerk.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, they have a reason why she's back, and I liked it. It works. Doctor Strange Damnation number 3 is, I think, the penultimate part of that story, although it's crossing over, so there's a couple more parts. But basically, Wong and his Midnight Suns go take on Mephisto. It doesn't go great, but there's some interesting stuff in it. I've been really enjoying this Damnation series.
Is it really Wong and his Midnight
Wong and the Midnight Suns, yep.
That's a good band name.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Ninjak number 5 finishes the first story arc of Ninjak, which I've been really enjoying. Quantum of Woody number 4 is the penultimate part of that story, and it's fun and weird, and I've been really enjoying it. Valiant has just 2 really good books this week, and definitely recommend it. That's all we've got for this week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some movies and TV.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
All right, we're going to check in on a couple things that Nick and I have been watching. I have watched the Netflix original movie Mute, which is directed by Duncan Jones, who did Source Code and Moon,
yep.
And then most recently the Warcraft movie.
Yeah, don't hold that against him.
This is one
he's got some good sci-fi under his belt.
There's a weird thing with Netflix. Like this feels like something that was supposed to be a theatrical release, and then maybe like the testing wasn't good, and they released it on Netflix instead.
Sort of like the, what was the...
Cloverfield Paradox.
Yeah.
Cloverfield Paradox, and maybe even Bright. Like, all of these are like A-list movie stars doing movies for Netflix seems weird, and this feels like a movie that in a different time they would have released in the theaters.
But I guess it is like just by Nate, maybe that's just the changing face of things.
Maybe.
It's definitely lower stakes to go through Netflix, but maybe some actors are just appreciating that they don't have to, like, you don't, they don't go around and like tour, and like Will Smith wasn't going on talk shows and promoting Bright.
Yeah.
So there's probably less stress on them, too.
Maybe so.
But anyway.
I don't know. It's interesting. So Mute is it's set in a future Germany. It's got a little bit of a cyberpunk vibe. And the story here is about a bartender, played by Alexander Skarsgård, he's Amish. And he, in his early days, it opens with like a near drowning where he basically loses his ability to speak and his mother won't let the doctors operate on him because of their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So he grows up mute. And now he's this mute bartender who sort of... He lives in this technological world. Like, he's not super... He'll drive a car, but he uses a pencil and paper to write down his like things that he's saying.
Yeah.
There's a scene where he goes into a diner and the guy sort of like recognizes he's uncomfortable with the TV and he turns the TV off. There's like an interesting little character bit.
Mm-hmm.
He has a girlfriend played by Sinib Sila, an actress I don't know, but basically she falls afoul of these gangsters and he winds up descending in a sort of criminal underworld to go looking for her. At the same time, Paul Rudd is playing this guy named Cactus Bill, who has spectacular facial hair. We're talking like his character from Anchorman level facial hair here. He's like an ex spy who's also like a doctor now, like an illegal doctor working for the mob.
Hmm.
His partner is played by Justin Theroux in this unrecognizable like blonde wig. He's looking almost like this hippie dude. You get the sense the two of them are like, they were partners in the military. They were surgeons in the military. They have what is probably a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's heavily hinted. And Paul Rudd has a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to keep her safe. So their whole side story is going on. And they're sort of in this underworld thing. And there's different gangsters having warfare with each other. These guys are doing some kind of illegal surgeries. There's a whorehouse they're operating around on. And they have a sort of parallel storyline to Leo, Alexander Skarsgård characters, which all intersects in a very interesting way by the end. And I never knew exactly where it was going,
uh-huh.
but it looks really interesting. It's an interesting world, and I really think it delivered really well. I was very impressed with it.
I'd like to see this. I've heard like I think somewhat mixed reviews.
Yeah,
but I'm a huge fan of Moon. I actually quite like Source Code as kind of his like somewhat more mainstream suspense thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard I don't know if this matters even at all that on the sci-fi front that this was meant to be set in the same timeline as Moon.
Yeah.
Which is kind of almost irrelevant because Moon is so isolated that
it's possible though, because this is also kind of isolated.
Really matter.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of a shared universe, even if it's kind of only in the director's head that mm-hmm. they exist in the same universe. But I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear you liked it because I was wanting to try this movie.
I would give it a look. I have a feeling you'll like it, and I was. I wasn't sure about it.
Was it written by Duncan Jones, out of curiosity?
No, it's written by somebody else.
Okay, I'm just curious.
It's not on the level of, say, Moon, or even maybe Source Code, but it's a solid flick. I enjoyed it.
Cool.
Nick, you've been watching a bunch of fall TV.
Well, yeah, a lot of the network televisions just started doing their spring premieres,
yeah.
Adding in some shows. Some are good, some are mediocre. I think my favorite one is Deception, which is about a stage magician, big guy, I think Chris Angel, but yeah. A little more...
less douchey?
Less douchey and more kind of quintessential magician, like tricks.
A little
tricks.
More Copperfield?
Yeah, a little more Copperfield. At the beginning, one of his biggest things gets outed that he has a twin brother that he uses for like teleportation,
acts
and things like that. And when his brother gets framed for murder, by a rival magician. So right. If you, have seen the movies Now You See Me,
right.
I think that kind of falls into those same kind of area.
I'll tell my brother, no, he has an interest in stage magician stuff since he did that once upon a time.
And it's framed really fun and sort of explaining how a magician doesn't act. But it's got a good sort of cast. Vinnie Jones is in it, which mm-hmm. I haven't seen him in a while.
But so he winds up working as a consultant to the police, right?
Yeah, he winds up working as a consultant to the FBI as sort of giving them another way to view the cases that they're dealing
right.
with.
Right, I'm sure he's like an expert in like misdirection.
Misdirection, and, deception.
Yeah, all of that stuff.
It's white collar, it's bones, it's
castle. It's that. It's not meaty by any means, but it is very entertaining.
Okay.
And I like the cast. It's a good group of people. The other one I watched is For the People, which is a show by Shonda Rhimes and one other person. It's about... a new group of people who are prosecutors and defense attorneys in the New York criminal justice system. It was very interesting. I do have to say, Shonda Rhimes does make pretty watchable television.
Mm-hmm.
Not always great. I don't like How to Get Away with Murder. It's just not for me. But it's not to say Viola Davis is a bad actress. She's amazing. But this one, It's just pretty simple. I like Hope Davis, who plays sort of the lead defense attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But it does paint kind of a, you're never going to win as a defense attorney against the giant government, which is a little dark. But there were some fun character moments, and enough to make me want to watch the second episode.
Hmm.
And then
there was Collateral?
Collateral, which is actually a Netflix miniseries that they're doing. I think it's like an eight episode series. It takes place in Britain about the murder of a pizza delivery guy. It looks kind of random, but definitely leads into some darker places. But it's told from various perspectives in the country. So, like a kind of beleaguered housewife and a pregnant police officer who's the lead detective. And then John Sim, the master from Doctor Who.
I haven't seen a pregnant lead detective since Fargo.
Yeah, I know.
And is that the one played by Rose?
Rose plays the sort of beleaguered housewife with kids from Doctor Who.
Whose name I've forgotten.
Billy Piper.
Billy Piper. And then John Sim, who played the master in Doctor Who, plays kind of a lead member of the labor union for... that is kind of on the outs in the government.
So it's a Doctor Who reunion.
It's a Doctor Who reunion. He actually plays, I think, her brother, if I'm not mistaken.
Hmm.
But it's just really handled very well. It's a little on the slow side, but I think there's a lot going for it with just sort of race relations and sort of just seeing that kind of side of government from the British perspective is interesting to me, at least, because it's completely opposite from what we deal with. And So there was a lot to like about it.
I watched, I don't watch a lot of network TV, but I watched Rise, which is Jason Kadam's new show. It's he's the guy who did Parenthood and Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
And it stars Ted Mosby from Better Off Dead.
Which is kind of a detriment for me because I don't like him.
He's actually good in this, though.
Okay.
So Friday Night Lights was all about sort of the is very sincere look at sort of, you know, the football program and high school and that kind of stuff. Rise is almost the opposite. It's about like a high school theater program, and this guy who's an English teacher basically wants to become. He takes over the theater program. I forget who the actress is who's taking it, but they sort of butt heads a little bit, and he's like wanting to take chances. So he wants to do sort of this edgy play instead of just like Grease, and he wants to do some things with it, and he gets the job. And then he like wants to recruit their quarterback, who's like who can rap and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sort of butts heads with the coach, and so it's all the stuff about high school, like you know sports versus theater and arts versus you know education and all that kind of stuff. And it's very Jason Kadam sort of weepy, hard on its sleeve kind of stuff. But I really liked it. It's got a good finale where it's sort of they bring them all together, and you know the theater people start working together. And they've got some good kid actors. I don't know if I'll stick with it, but it's definitely worth a look for people who like stuff
pretty
like This Is Us.
It's always interesting to find a network television show that you like, because there's not many of them.
No, I'm pretty picky, and it's usually the ones I like are comedies. So, again, I don't know how long I'll stick with it, but this reminds me a little bit of what I liked about Friday Night Lights. We'll see if it can reach those heights.
And
the other thing is the one that we're both watching, which is on Hulu, which is The Looming Tower.
I've only seen the first episode.
And I've seen all but the most recent one.
But this is sort of about the events leading up to the 9/11 attack.
Yeah, it's a period piece. It takes place in, what, 1992, 94, something like that?
Yeah.
It is during the Clinton era. It's got a guy playing Richard Clark, the guy from Boardwalk Empire, and Preacher is playing Richard Clark, the counterterrorism guy who becomes a big part of it.
Jeff
Daniels plays an FBI guy.
He plays the head of the FBI, and he's
another Skarsgård. I don't remember which Skarsgård.
It's Peter Skarsgård.
Skarsgård plays the CIA guy, and they're sort of butting heads because the way this the FBI deals with its intel is to sort of go after people through the legal system, but in so doing, they sort of blow all this intel. The CIA wants to hold on to it and let bad things happen so that they can play a longer game and take out terrorists.
Yeah.
And the two of them, as they're playing games with this information sharing, things are getting missed, and the result is going to be 9/11. We all know it. But it's fascinating to watch this sort of interplay.
Well, real quick, is this a, like, a decidedly fictionalized account of this, or is this meant to be kind of based on pretty close on true events?
On fictionalized. I mean, yeah. it's a drama.
Yeah, it's definitely a drama. And
the other thing that I think they do really well is that they have like Jeff Daniels' character is polygamous. He is married.
Oh, yeah.
He has a separate family, and he's cheating on his wife with another woman,
and then cheating on that one with another woman.
And it's like, yeah, this whole story of him. And there's an Arabic agent in the FBI. He's one of the few guys who speaks Arabic.
Yeah.
And is he having trouble getting his relationship going because he keeps getting called away for these emergency missions?
Yeah.
And Bill Camp from Night Of plays one of the CIA guys, and he meets a woman overseas, and there's a story of all that. All these characters have, like, personal lives that are going on.
Yeah.
And we delve into that stuff. And that is, I mean, I'm sure it's based on reality, but it's also
highly fictionalized and dramatized. Yeah, they have to, like, heighten it a little bit.
Right.
And it does a really good job of seeing that these guys have big jobs, but they're also just people.
Right. The Peter Sarsgaard stuff, the head of that task force for the CIA, he's creepy.
Yeah.
And he plays it very well, and he surrounded himself with all women interns. I think Jeff Daniels refers to him as the Manson family, which is really, really creepy.
They're all operatives. I mean,
they're all operatives. They're not interns. They're all female operatives.
Yeah.
So it's basically him and that.
That's such a specific thing. Is that based on something?
No idea.
I'd be curious.
For all
to
I know, it could be.
Because that sounds a little outrageous.
It's
like it could be goofy. Or not goofy.
No, it's not played goofy.
It'd be hard for me to see it as like seeming realistic.
No, it works.
Okay. I'd like to see this because one of the best things I watched in the last few years was that People vs. O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, this is in that vein.
And I watched a little bit of, and I did not think this was up the caliber, but like I watched a little bit of Waco.
Yeah.
But at least like I was interested because I'm curious to see historical events from my era reconsidered and recontextualized.
Yeah.
So something like this sounds interesting.
Well, I thought this sounded boring. When I heard the premise, this sounded boring to me. It is not boring. It's really good. It reminds me of what I liked about, say, Homeland.
Mm-hmm.
And even like a little bit of Newsroom.
Newsroom.
It's got a little bit of that too because of Jeff Daniels.
Oh, yeah.
But there's sort of like, the sort of good people who have human lives and human frailties dealing with these big things, and everyone has their own agenda, and they're, you know, what's going to happen. We know what's going to happen. It's going to go badly, but it's fascinating to see why.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. All right, that wraps things up for us this week. We'll be back with more next week, and until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.